Firstly, I want to congratulate you for your movie.
Thank you.
Unfortunately, I haven't seen it yet because I had a problem with the private screener, but I saw the trailer and I cried. So.
Oh, the trailer? I don't like the trailer very much. Because
why?
I don't know what trailer you saw, whether it's a Romanian trailer or the...
No.
It's an international trailer.
Yeah.
Maybe actually that's fine. They did an English trailer where they changed the music and they made the music very heavy, and it feels like a heavy film. But the international trailer is lighter, so it's maybe nicer.
I know you said in other interviews that you wanted to be a low volume movie.
Very much low key, low volume, quiet, yeah. Definitely quiet. Yes.
Well, firstly, I want to ask you some questions about yourself. Mm. So
I'm 64, Italian born.
Yeah, I think everybody knows that, but. Yeah. What I didn't find on the internet is that you're a well-known figure now in the movie industry, in the film industry, but you worked at the bank for 12 years. So how did your passion for film
started? Never believe what you read on the internet. I did not work for 12 years. Somebody else asked me the same question. 12 years in the bank. No, I worked for 3 years in the bank.
But every side says 12 years.
But it's not true. I've only worked from 1980 to 1983 in the bank. And in 83, I left and started working as a runner, as a T-boy, on a film in Thailand called The Killing Fields. That was my first filmmaking working experience. I had loved cinema since I was young, certainly a teenager. I grew up in Milan mostly, and the girls in Milan didn't like me very much. So I spent all my evenings at the Cinematheque, at the Cineteca Italiana in Milan, and I watched every film, silent, Russians, Americans, Japanese, you may name it. I saw a lot of cinema, and I loved a lot of cinema. But I always thought it was something like a hobby or like an interest. I never really believed it could be a career or an occupation for life. And so I, without much imagination, I ended up studying economics at school, and then I was a banker for a while. And then I saw that, although maybe sometimes banking was actually quite interesting, investment banking this was. But it's not, wasn't what we were doing, what we were creating was not something I was interested in long-term. And so I left and I started from scratch, and I was given the opportunity to be the runner on this very big production, a British production in Thailand. And I started working with a London-based film producer called David Putnam, who had been very successful, had won an Oscar for a film called Chariots of Fire, and from whom I tried to learn. I failed to learn, but I did try to learn a few things. And I worked with him on and off for 10 years, and then I started working for myself.
Okay, so the story on the internet that you went to Bangkok even though the initial refusal is...
It's not true.
False.
It's not okay. True. What David told me was that obviously as a banker I didn't know anything about the film industry, but they were working on a film in Thailand in April, March, April, and that if I were in Bangkok at that time, I would be able to look and learn how films are made. So he certainly didn't say no.
Okay.
He didn't say, here is a job. He didn't say, I'll pay you to fly out. So I paid for myself to fly out. I found a hotel next to the big hotel where the English crew was staying. I did all that. But when I arrived and looked at the offices, the production offices in Bangkok, I wasn't told, go away. I was told, here's a tray full of drinks. Go and give them around.
It's interesting that these stories are all over the internet, not just on one side.
It's,
so
it's never believe internet. Yeah,
true. So the idea of the box office hit The Full Monty was yours, but you chose another man to direct and write it. Why
yes.
was it, and why, and how did the idea come up?
Well, the idea came up because a friend of a friend came to my office and told me a story about a man who used to do stripograms, which are those situations, I don't know if they really happen anymore very much, but if you have a hen party, for example, or a birthday party amongst girls, you would have in the middle of the party, someone turns up a young handsome man stands up, takes his clothes off and sings happy birthday or that kind of thing. That was a, they are called stripograms. And it was a story of that and drug dealing and all sorts of strange things. I wasn't interested in the story as, that he told me, but I was interested in the notion of men taking their clothes off for money. And I had recently seen a lovely film by Ken Loach, the great British director Ken Loach, called Riff Raff, where there was a group, very mixed group of workers working on a building site, on a constructing a bâtiment, what do you call it, a housing estate. And there was a fat one, a skinny one, everybody with their own problems, an African, American, actually, you know, in that case, you would call him an African British man, a mix of people. And I imagined what would happen to those people at the end of that film, because at the end of that film, the building that they were working on burns down, and they walk in front of a poster of the Chippendales, which was a famous group of stripteasers. In fact, for a while, I even thought of asking Ken Loach to direct it. So the way that I learned to work, which was a common way to work in the Anglo-Saxon world, in particular in America, and in the UK, was not to start looking for a director and then developing the project with the director, but was first of all to go and find a writer to write a script, and then once the script was ready, to find a director to direct it. It's not the way that the majority of the world works, where films are director-driven, really. It's a director, usually, or the writer-director, that is the main force behind a film, main engine to get the film going. In this case, in England, it's quite normal for producers to initiate projects. So I looked for a writer, and I met a few writers, and one of them was the wonderful, lovely man called Simon Beaufoy, and I told him about the idea, and I thought we should set it in Wales, because I had spent a couple of years in Wales at school, and I knew about the mining industry and all the small towns that had lost work and lost a way of being and living because of the closures of the mines in the 70s and the 80s. And he said he didn't know anything about mines, but he knew about steelworks because he was from Sheffield, from Yorkshire, and he said, I can write it about steelworks. And I said, sure, let's go to Sheffield and look at Sheffield. We went to Sheffield. It's a very photogenic place, hills all over the place.
My
everywhere you look,
studied in Sheffield.
Everywhere you look, there is a background, so it was good.
Yeah.
And then he wrote a fantastic script. And then after that, I started looking for a director, and I saw a small film, a short film made by Peter Cattaneo, and which was very realistic, very naturalistic, because I thought that the Fomonti needed a very straightforward treatment, otherwise it could have become either a farce or a melodrama. And I wanted the range of the comedy, the range of the performances has to be quite limited, quite real, quite solid. And Peter had shown that in a small film lovely small film called Loved Up he had done, and so I asked him to direct it. He liked the script, and then we made it. Sorry, long story about.
It's okay. I like long stories. I hope we're good with the time. Okay, so when was the moment when you decided that you want to direct and write your own movies?
Okay, so I was in Australia, and I had just spent 7 months in Australia preparing a film with a big international cast. It was Nicole Kidman and Russell Crowe and an important Australian director called Jocelyn Morehouse. And the day before we started filming, the film collapsed for a number of reasons that are too boring to get into. And that very same day, I had to tell 300 Australians that had changed their lives and reorganized the school children and their homes in order to work on this film, that the film was not going to happen. And it was really a very, very bad day for my career and also for me emotionally. That same day I opened a newspaper, and there was a little notice, a little Reuters news agency flash about these 23 Sri Lankans who had pretended to be the national handball team of Sri Lanka, got themselves invited by a tournament, from a tournament in Bavaria. With the invitation, they went to the German embassy in Colombo to get a visa. They got the visa, they went to Germany, and they all disappeared in Germany. They played three games of games they never played, so they lost them, and then they disappeared. And I thought, well, this is a wonderful story. It deals with people who struggle, people who have dreams, people who have hopes of changing their lives, the lives of their families, the lives of their children. But it's also, like the Full Monty, it also has a comedy engine. The engine of the story is sort of silly, pretending to be somebody you're not, sport, not being able to play it, a mixed group of people, obviously. I could see that there were some clear parallels with the Full Monty, and I felt that because it was going to be the only way really to make it was to make it in Sri Lanka about the Sri Lankans, in the Sri Lankan language, I thought nobody outside of Sri Lanka is ever going to see this film, even if we manage to make a film and is seen in Sri Lanka. And we won't be dealing with big Hollywood stars, we won't be dealing with important directors, nobody is going to quit the film, because I'm going to write it, and I'm going to direct it, and I'm going to produce it, so nobody is going to leave the film, and the film will get made. And so it wasn't so much a desire to become a director or a writer, but it was a desire for even more control, for making sure that all the efforts that I had spent or one can spend on a production, on preparing a film, I had literally spent 7 months in Australia away from my growing up little daughters. I was very upset about that. I said, this is not going to happen again. I'm not going to let the big machinery of Hollywood stop me from making a film. So I'm going to make a very small film, and I'm going to do everything on it. Well, not everything, of course, but certainly I'm going to be the director, so the director doesn't quit. I'm going to be the writer, so the director doesn't quit and doesn't fight with the director. And I'm going to be the producer, so I will know that the film gets made. And that's how I started. And when I did it, the experience of writing together with a great friend, someone who became a great friend, a wonderful playwright in Sri Lanka called Ranti De Chikera. I'm still talking to her now. I'm trying to help her to make her first film as a director. And the experience of directing in Sri Lanka was enormous fun. Was just fun. The film is not great, but the process of reading this little story and then 2 years later having a completed film, which very satisfyingly was an enormous success in Sri Lanka. Very, very big success in Sri Lanka. For them, it was a Sri Lankan film. It wasn't an Italian film. It wasn't. I was irrelevant. And I was, in a way, irrelevant. It was a film made by a Sri Lankan crew. It was a film made by the Sri Lankan actors. It was produced in Sri Lanka by a wonderful Sri Lankan director called Prasanna Vitanage. The experience was really, really fun. And so I thought, well, if I ever find another story or another situation that inspires me, I should try and do it again. And that's what happened when I made Still Life, and that's what happened again when I made Nova Special.
Yeah, that was my next question. You said that you found the story in a newspaper for Nowhere Special.
Yeah.
But was it something more to it, like a personal connection or a personal reason for wanting to do this movie?
Well, yes, in the sense that, but I guess that every time you read something and if it strikes you, it strikes you because of your life or your experience or your imagination or something. And in this case, what I was struck by is how special the relationship between the young father and the four-year-old boy must have been, and how difficult the position the father found himself in, and what a wonderful father he must have been. It was about parenthood, and it talked to me about my own parenthood, my own relationship with my daughters. I have three grown-up daughters now, but of course I was there when they were growing up, except for those 7 months in Australia. I was there when they were growing up, when they were very small. And I tried to imagine what I would have done if I had been in the same situation that this father had found himself in. of course, very difficult to imagine it because I have a big family, I have lots of friends, I have a network of support if I had found myself in that situation. And also, my daughters have a wonderful mother who would have looked after them. Instead, in this case, the father did not have a family behind him, did not have a wide circle of friends to whom with whom to share the situation and maybe the solution of the problem he found himself in, and had to basically deal with it by himself. And I tried to imagine what that meant. And then I did a lot of research about adoption and what kind of people are interested in adopting and why they come to that decision. I talked to people who have been adopted. I talked to people who were hoping to adopt. I talked to the agencies who help in the adoption process. I also talked to organizations that deal with children who are faced with bereavement, who are go through bereavement, who might have lost or are losing a sibling or a parent or a grandparent, just to understand how a four-year-old would react to the news or the feels, the sense that the situation around them is changing and something bad is going to happen. I read a lot of books and biographies, autobiographies of people who have been told they don't have long to live, just to understand what that feeling might be like. So it certainly was an attempt at understanding the situation and seeing myself in the situation and trying to imagine what I would have done if I had been in his place. It was really about, mainly about parenthood to start with, what attracted me to the project. And of course the situation that the film portrays is a very sad one. And I thought it's very, very important that we find a way of recording or recreating the situation in a very undramatic way, because the story is so dramatic, or the events are so dramatic, that we want to sort of catch something without making it dramatic, without trying to make people cry, without putting on a lot of music and forcing emotions. It had to be handled in a very delicate way, and I think we, on the whole, have succeeded in doing that, thanks in large part to the work of the two central actors of James Norton and Daniel Lamont, who inhabited the characters, the people rather, because the characters is the wrong word, the people I had written or I had imagined so sweetly, so calmly, so truthfully, so with so much tenderness and real affection that they were able really to make happen in front of the screen what I had written. I was very happy with that.
I'm glad this happened. You talked about the main theme of the father's love for his son.
Yeah.
I found a similar theme and a very similar frame with the poster of Nowhere Special in De Sica's Ladri di Biciclette.
Yes.
Is this all a coincidence or is it a tribute?
Obviously, before making this film, I went back and looked at Bicycle Thieves, Ladri di Biciclette, a lot. In particular, I tried to understand what was so special about the ending of Bicycle Thieves and that hand of the boy that takes a hold of the hand of the father and leads him, or gives him security, gives him hope, gives him strength. The boy in Bicycle Thieves is older, much older than, well, not much older, a bit older than our boy. But the emotion that is derived and the moment of that shift from who is the parent and who is the child, which I wanted in our little film, in Nowhere Special, is very much present at the end of Bicycle Thieves. It is It is the son at the father at the end of Bicycle Thieves who is lost, and it's the son who gives him that moment of strength and affection, just after a confrontation, just after a moment of unhappiness between the two of them. And that did influence me certainly, and influenced the last action of the film, the father, the son giving his hand to his father. That yeah. is a moment of Bicycle Thieves. But I also, the last shot of the film is stolen in a way from a wonderful, wonderful film called Babe, which was an Australian film about a shepherd and a pig. You have to see it. It's a great film, Babe. It's called Babe, and it's the relationship between the shepherd and this pig who helps him with the sheep. And the last two shots are really a duplication of the last shots of Babe. So the inspiration comes from everywhere. As I said, I don't have imagination. I steal either from newspapers for my ideas or from other better filmmakers for my filmmaking. And sometimes it works. No, sometimes it works. Those people are better filmmakers. It's not difficult to say De Sica was a better filmmaker than I can ever dream of being. But so what? Who cares? Everybody, you know, even great painters had better painters to follow, to inspire them. And we all take from other people, so why not?
Yeah, that's true. Unfortunately, we don't have any more time for the last two questions, so... Thank you very much for your time.
No, thank you.
It was a pleasure.